Dear ladies and gentlemen, together with Rainer Forst, I would like to welcome you to the second evening of Philip Pettit's Frankfurt Lecture. Yesterday evening, we had the pleasure to learn about the distinction of political legitimacy and social justice, and how a republican theory of liberty argues for a democratic model of legitimacy. But in the end, Philip left us in a dilemma-like situation. If I may quote from the last paragraph of his handout from yesterday, a just social order need not be legitimate. A legitimate social order need not be just. I'm curious to learn how we can get out of this situation. The title of this evening's lecture is Prioritizing Justice and Democracy. Dear Philip, thank you again for speaking to us this evening. The floor is yours.
Maybe I should begin with a qualification of the sentence that that was just quoted from the handout yesterday. How does it say? What I really meant to say, no. What I wanted to bring out was not that, so to speak, these are completely independent variables, justice and democracy, or justice and legitimacy. I don't think they are completely independent. In other words, I think the minimum requirements for justice will require a certain amount of democracy, perhaps, and vice versa. That if you have, if you're going to have a system that is legitimate and democratic, there has to be at least a basic provision in justice for how people relate to one another. Those are familiar points. The point I want to emphasize, though, is that it's still going to be the case that you can have, there are two, think of it in terms of political and social justice, if you like, rather than justice and legitimacy. As I said, the names or the tags are really irrelevant. But the point is that you can have an improvement in one dimension without an improvement in the other. And you can be in the position of having to choose between regimes. If you're ranking regimes, you can have a regime that scores high on the justice dimension or the social justice dimension and lower on the democratic or legitimacy dimension, and another that scores higher on the legitimacy, lower on the justice. And that leaves us with a question as to how those values should be, those concerns should be weighted against one another. And that's really the starting point for this evening's lecture. So just to make it vivid, and maybe excessively vivid in a way, it might be misleading, but still to make it vivid, think about justice, social justice, as what I call a horizontal type of concern. It's a concern for how people relate to one another, both individually and also via the organizations that they belong to, such as churches, associations, corporations, and so on. And to have justice in that horizontal dimension, say on a Republican view, is to have measures and institutions in place that ensure that each individual is adequately resourced and protected in the range of the basic liberties. This will be, by Republican lights, a very, very just system to the extent to which people have enough of that resourcing and protection, enough of that status in relation to one another, that they pass what I call the eyeball test. They can look one another in the eye without reason for fear or deference. If you like, you can think of that in discourse type terms, as in they're equipped with everything, as you might think of it, that might enable them to be participants in a rational discourse. In other words, might enable them to satisfy the sort of conditions that Habermas would lay down as preconditions for being able to conduct rational discourse with one another. But you can go a long way in peoples having that sort of status and enjoying that sort of status vis-a-vis one another in the horizontal dimension, and yet be under, in the vertical dimension, a state that, of course, maintains that social order, where there isn't as much of what you would want. There isn't as much control of that state as you would like. And to that extent, as I was putting it yesterday, the state is less legitimate than you might wish. In other words, there isn't as much political justice as you might wish. Now, imagine for a moment different systems, perhaps different actual world systems. And here we've got a system in which there's a good deal of horizontal justice, say in Republican terms, but there's not a great amount of legitimacy or political justice. So for example, think about picking a couple of, you know, arcane examples. Think about Rome about 200 AD. You might say from the point of view of the ordinary citizens of Rome, you know, it was pretty well as good as it got in those days. You know, it really wasn't bad from the point of view of the citizens of Rome, how they related to one another, what legal rights they had, what economic welfare they enjoyed, and so on. But on the democratic dimension, it was pretty terrible, because by then, clearly, any vestiges of the republic that really mattered had disappeared. So you might think of that as a system that scores quite well in the horizontal dimension. Actually, not very well by our standards, but for the time, quite well, would really rather poorly in the vertical dimension. And now compare that system, just think about it in your minds, with Rome 200 years earlier, or 230, 40 years earlier, in the late Republic. And I don't think it's outlandish to say that in the late Republic, people would not have been as well off as they were, say, 150 AD or so, in the middle of the second century of the Common Era. They weren't as well off. They didn't enjoy perhaps as much justice in relation to one another. There was perhaps more clientelism or whatever. But there was a lot more legitimacy or democratic or political justice, if you wish. And now the question is, when we're looking at two systems like that, and part of, I take it, the job of political theory isn't just to talk about the ideal, the, you know, absolutely out there transcendental ideal, as Amartya Sen calls it, but equally to be able to rank real world systems, or indeed imagined systems that are in some ways less than perfect. And now the question is, in ranking systems like that, which do you weight more heavily? Do you think, gee, I really treasure the justice and the fact that, you know, you really have a pretty good standing vis-a-vis others. Of course, it's all, you know, at the mercy, in a way, of the sort of emperor that you happen to have, and that's certainly a loss, but on the other hand, there's a compensation. Whereas thinking about the late Republic, you know, well, it's maybe terrific that, as it were, it is a res publica in a certain sense, and there is, you know, prior to the civil wars or whatever, there is a good deal of popular control of who's in power and what's done in power, and there are the courts that are pretty open and so on, and that's great, but, you know, they didn't do so well in terms of horizontal justice. And the question is now, how do you weight those two dimensions against one another? Now, what I'm going to do today is to suggest to you that that you're going to go, or at least you're likely to go one way and think of them as more or less on a par, these two dimensions, democracy, let's say, and justice. But if you think of political theory in another way, then you're going to prioritize democracy. And I'm going to suggest that that other way is actually a more attractive way to think about political theory. Okay, so the two ways of thinking about political theory, thinking about what you're doing when you're doing political philosophy in the way we all do it, probably in this room, one way of thinking about it is, I describe it here in the handout as a consumer-centered way of thinking about political theory, and the other I call a citizen-centered way of thinking about political theory. And I'm going to suggest if you adopt the consumer-centered way, then you're very likely to think about these two dimensions as being more or less on a par, whereas if you go in the other direction and think about them in the citizen-centered way, you're going to think of democracy as having a certain important sort of priority. So I don't know whether I'm going to convince you of this, but I'm going to do my best. So let me try to describe, first of all, the consumer-centered way of thinking and why it might lead you to weight these two things, these two concerns, more or less as being on a par. When you do political theory in a consumer-centered way, you think about different possible think about what Rawls does early in A Theory of Justice. Right? He gives us the idea of contractual eligibility. In other words, you imagine yourself in the original position under the veil of ignorance, so you don't know how you're going to fare in any of the possible regimes that you might be party to setting up. And now what he does is he invites you to think about different possible regimes. Of course, one of them is the regime that's governed by his two principles. So that's one candidate, right? And then you're invited to think about another candidate, which he describes, for example, as the utilitarian candidate, where the average degree of happiness or utility, welfare, however that's measured, enjoyed by people in this society is really pretty high. So if you know you're a gambler, you know, gambling sort of mentality, you think, hey, you know, that's where I've got the best expected returns. That's that other regime. So just think about those two regimes. And Rawls invites you to think about which would appeal most to you rationally, assuming that you are concerned, given the veil of ignorance, only about what he calls primary goods. Those are the goods that you would want no matter what sort of human being you turned out to be. So you only think about opportunity and income and wealth and the basis of self-respect and liberty as he thinks of it. And now he asks you, where would you prefer to live? Which regime? And you think about the two principles regime and you realize that in that regime, what's going to be true is that even if it turns out you very badly for you, still, you're not going to be that badly off because you're going to be better off than you would have been under any other alternative regime. And you think about the utilitarian one and you recognize, well, I could do really well. You know, that lets you go really, really high. But on the other hand, I might suffer ill luck and end up at the very bottom, and the bottom in that regime is a lot lower than the bottom in the two principles regime. And he invites you to think, well, which would you prefer? Now, I think of this as a consumer-centered way of thinking. You know, I'm sure they do in Germany, they carry it as they do in America and Australia and elsewhere, these, you know, lists of the world's most livable cities. You know, and you're told that, you know, you're given the list number one, number two, number three, and basically this list of the world's most livable cities is made up on the basis of an index of goods, you know, that you would expect to enjoy on average if you're a resident of that city. And they tell you that, hey, you ought to be in, you know, the best is Vancouver or Sydney or Melbourne or wherever it might be. And it's a bit like that, isn't it, in political theory considered in a consumer-centered way. You're asked, which answers, as it were, best to your concerns about your life, in particular those concerns now as impersonalized, made impersonal, because in the Rawlsian sense, you're asked to think about this under a veil of ignorance as to the sort of characteristics you have. Now, that's what I think of as a sort of consumer-centered theory of a way of thinking about political theory. And of course, you might have any criterion of political evaluation. You might have any one or another index of the goods that matter in thinking in that way. After all, for Rawls, it's the primary goods that matter. But somebody else might say, oh, well, it's utility that matters, and you should be looking at different regimes with a view to either the average expected or minimum or whatever it might be utility you would expect to enjoy there. Or another might say, no, you should think in terms of resources, you know, like Dworkin. Or another might, you know, introduce all sorts of other parts, like basic capability in sense terms, or indeed freedom, whether understood in a republican sense or not. I've got to just say I'm making a mental note here, and I might refer to that note in the event of some questions coming up in discussion. But putting that mental note aside, which I'm not going to share with you, I'm going to suggest now that no matter what your index of relevant goods is, no matter what your criterion of political evaluation is, if you think in the consumer-centered way, you're going to be, you know, in this observer-type mode of looking at, oh, I might live there, or live here, or live here, and you've got, you know, your criterion. Okay, and now what I want to suggest, let me just add one thing more about this consumer-centered way of thinking. In adopting it, you might work with what we call ideal theory or non-ideal theory. These phrases, an unfortunate phrase in my view, introduced by Rawls, is understood in many, many different ways, but what I mean is this. You might, in assessing regimes, work with the assumption, for example, that whatever regime you're looking at, there's total compliance with whatever laws are in place. That's the idealization that Rawls works with. Or you might work with the sort of idealization that you only look at regimes where everybody has, say, complete information about what's going on in the regime. That's a sort of economic style of idealization. Or you might assume about human beings that they are very compassionate and sympathetic, and against the background of that idealization, look at your alternatives. Or, of course, you mightn't put any idealization in at all. I just mentioned this to say that's an orthogonal issue from my point of view. You could, the issue of whether you're going to think in a consumer-centered way about what you're doing in political theory arises whether or not you choose to idealize in that manner. Because whether or not you choose to idealize, you're still going to be in the ranking business, in the business of ranking regimes against one another. Now, if you do idealize, of course, the regimes you're ranking against one another are all going to be abstract idealized models. They're not going to be regimes of the kind that could actually be realized, because we know idealizations, almost by definition, are not fulfilled in the actual world. If you don't idealize, the regimes you're looking at are at least capable of being fulfilled in the actual world. But that issue, which, say, Amartya Sen has drawn a lot of attention to in his recent book on justice, I'm going to just put aside, bring it up in discussion if you like. I think it's orthogonal to what I'm going to say today. Anyhow, now what I want to suggest, I hope you've got an image of what it is to do political theory in a consumer-centered way. So now what I want to suggest, if you think about political theory in a consumer-centered way, you know, looking at different regimes, ranking them by your favorite criterion, whatever that is, then I think it's going to be very natural for you to say, well, you know, what really matters in any regime is the status I have vis-a-vis other individuals in that regime, considered as individuals or as members of private groups, associations. So it's going to matter to me, you know, what I enjoy in relation to them. In republican terms, say what status I have in relation to them. In other terms, what utility, how I compare in relation to them, what resources I have in relation. That's certainly going to matter, and call that the horizontal dimension, the social justice dimension. So you've got to take that really into account. But of course, with each regime too, it's going to matter as to how far the government, the state, that organizes things, organizes this social order that we enjoy vis-a-vis one another, how far it is something that is, so to speak, a law unto itself, and how far it is under democratic control, which I take to be roughly equally shared control of the people living in the society. But you know, just as, and now let me go back to what I invited you to think about a moment ago, just as when you think about, you know, Rome 150, CE, the common era, versus Rome 50 or 60 BCE, before the common era, you sort of think, well, you know, the democracy is really a good thing about the earlier period, but on the other hand, it's really quite a good thing about the later period that there's more stability and there's more welfare and a better slice of the cake, as it were, in justice terms. And, you know, you'll trade them off against one another. I mean, you might think one is more important than the other, but there isn't anything about this way of doing political theory that would lead you to say, ah, first of all, democracy. That's what I worry about in the first place. And then, you know, whatever I can get by way of justice. Or on the other hand, there's no reason to think, well, what really matters is justice. I want that, or some degree of, you know, of high marks in that dimension. And after that, I'll worry about democracy. You might take any of those views. But the point is, neither of these dimensions, neither of these concerns has an inevitable priority, a higher weighting than the other. Now, there is a mental note that I made just against a point that might come up in discussion, but I want to say I think that that's broadly true. And just to, you know, maybe make that a little bit more vivid for a moment, imagine, I mean, Rawls, one thing that in a way I find disappointing, or found disappointing about that first book, is that he gave us so few candidates. You know, he gave us the two principles regime, and he gave us the, call it the gambling regime, the utilitarian regime, and one or two others. But who can remember what the other candidates were? I mean, there were three or four. Remember that page somewhere, quarter way into the theory of justice. And he could have given us a lot more, of course, of regimes, and asked us, in his favorite terms, to rank them with one another. And I think if you did that fuller Rawlsian exercise, I think you'd find that you'd be trading off political, as he would call them, political rights against social rights, you know? Well, you might say as between X and Y, those candidates, there really are so many more social rights in X than in Y, that the fact that there are fewer political rights is really outweighed, so you prefer X to Y. But again, you might, in another case, you can see how I'm going. It's going to be a matter of weighting that could go one way or the other. Now, what I want to describe for you is another way of doing political theory, of thinking about the enterprise we are all involved in, and I want to suggest that under this other way of thinking, you're going to find yourself having to give democracy a certain priority. I describe this, for want of a better term, as a citizen-centered way of doing political theory. In the consumer-centered way, you invited people, you presented regimes, you presented your favorite political philosophy, your favorite criterion of evaluation, and then you invited them, as so to speak, consumers, to think about which was actually the best regime and how they ranked against one another in terms of those that criterion. In a citizen-centered theory, as I think of it, what you do is something very different. You don't think of people as the consumers of whatever social structure, basic structure in Rawls's terms, is going to get set up. Rather, you think about them as the people who are going to construct a regime. They're the citizens, in the sense of those who make the regime, construct it, change it, modify it, maintain it, and keep it going. And you're talking to them in that sense as the role of makers of the institutions rather than consumers of the institutions. And now what you're going to be doing in talking to them is recommending to them, as a political theorist, that first of all they should, that this is the proper criterion, whatever it might be, utility, rights, resources, freedom. You're going to be recommending this to them, and you're going to be saying to them, that gives you reason for going this way rather than that way in the regime that you construct or maintain and so on. You're going to be addressing them in that way. In order to make clear what I have in mind, let me go to a distinction that people talk about in ethics. And that's the distinction between well, Michael Smith and I, in a paper, called it the distinction between an injunctive way of giving reasons to someone and a merely evaluative way of giving them reasons. Okay, so imagine someone is standing here beside me, and think about the different ways in which I can use ought statements to that person. I might say to him, you know, you ought to have had a better education. Now, when I say to the person, you ought to have had a better education, I'm not suggesting for one moment that this gives him a reason to do anything. What I'm just simply saying is that, you know, you'd be really a better person, or this would be a better world, if things had happened thus and so in the past. You had had a better education than you actually have. So though I use the word ought, I say you ought to have had a better education. I'm not, as it were, recommending anything to the person. It's a pure sort of grading exercise of assessing, so to speak, how the person is. Or I might say to the person, you ought to give up smoking. But I might say this understanding that it's completely beyond his or her capacity to give up smoking. It might be just a way of saying, you know, you really would be better off, you'd be healthier, etc., if you gave up smoking, rather than a way of saying, you ought to give up smoking by way of a recommendation. Now, call that a mere evaluation. So lots of the time when we evaluate courses of action with other people, we're just in that mere evaluation. We're not giving them reasons to do anything. We're just ranking or grading the different things they might do or the different ways they are or might be. But most of the time when we address oughts to other people, we do it in what I call here an addressive way or an injunctive way. So I say to someone, you know, someone is, let's say, going for interview for a job, I say, let him be a male, I say, you ought to wear a suit. I mean, I know you don't normally wear a suit, but you ought to wear a suit to interview. Now, what I'm not just saying it would be better for you if you wore a suit. What I'm saying is, I'm presupposing you've got the capacity to act on this consideration. And so I'm in a position where I'm going to advertise that, as it were. I'm going to blame that person for not taking this advice, unless, of course, that person comes back with a contrary consideration that reasonably silences my recommendation. So that's the lesson from ethics, is there are two ways in which we may evaluate other people, or indeed ourselves. You know, I might say to some like, you know, I really ought to be able to read Greek better. I might say that by way of just a self-evaluation, or I might say it by way of a self-recommendation, where I'm, so to speak, holding myself to account if I fail to act on that reason. Okay, now that distinction carries over into the political arena. So you might be, in telling people the different sort of advantages of different political systems, you might be treating this as a merely evaluative exercise. And that's in a way what you do in the consumer-centered approach. You're saying, you know, I think in terms of this criterion, that's the best. And you're just treating them as consumers who, like you, are observing and assessing these systems. But you might also be saying to people, treating them as addressees, treating them as people to whom you're making recommendations, you might be giving them reason for doing this or that in the institutions that they set up and maintain. You might be speaking to them in such a way that unless they give you counter considerations in return, you're really going to hold them to account for not responding to the recommendations that you give. When you're doing this addressive exercise, you presuppose a capacity to understand, register, and respond to the considerations, the evaluations that you're making. When you evaluate people in a merely evaluative way, in an observer way rather than a participant way, as you might call it, then you don't think of yourself as giving them considerations that they should respond to in action. Like when I say you ought to have had a better education, I'm not saying anything about what the person should do, but when I say you ought to wear a suit to the interview, I am giving them a recommendation. Now, I think of citizen-centered theory, political theory, as the theory which thinks of itself as saying to people in general about a society that this is, you know, this is how you should do things. This is the best way of setting up a society. Or I say, of course, I speak to fellow citizens and I say, look, this is what we ought to do. And I say, here's the reason why we ought to introduce a universal healthcare system, for example. And I start listing the, you know, the reasons. I'm addressing my fellow citizens virtually, maybe aspiring to address them, addressing a sample of them at any rate. And I'm saying to them, here are reasons for action. You know, you individually and we together have got the capacity to act on these. And I'm speaking to you now as potential makers of these institutions. And I'm saying this is what we ought to do. Now, it's addressive political theory taken in this way, but one thing very important about it, it's inclusively addressive. And I think most of the political, when we do political theory, talking about ways in which things should be done, we do always, I think of ourselves as addressing citizens taken as a whole in the society envisaged. Although it must be said, there is a sort of addressive political theory that might be addressed not to citizens taken as a whole, but, for example, to a vanguard party. I mean, that's what vanguardism is, I guess, in political theory, is assuming that there's, you know, think of Lenin's party, that there's a party, a small group, who are going to take a who are going to take charge of a society, and you're telling them, so to speak, what they should do in organizing this society. Or another way of not being inclusive but still being addressive would be, for example, if, go back to my example of yesterday, a colonial administration calls me in, extremely unlikely, and asks my advice about what it should do in this or that colony that it controls. They're asking to be addressed, and I give them reasons for doing this or that. And that is a sort of political theory, but I think of it as a maybe a degenerate form of political theory. Political theory in the sense in which most of us do it, we don't think it appropriate to regard the addressee as such a managerial elite, as you might put it. Actually, I'm reminded of this, as many of you will be, of Habermas on Knowledge and Human Interest, that early book, where he talks about the cognitive interests that drive different sorts of theory from natural science, say manipulative, I think, interests, he described it, to social science, as hermeneutic interests, I think is how he described it, and then to normative theory or in political theory, he talked, I think the phrase he used was an emancipatory interest, that this is what should be guiding us in doing this sort of theory. Now that's what that's an argument in a way for thinking about what you're doing in political theory as you're speaking to your fellow citizens, if you're, you know, just thinking of this, or maybe in imagination you're speaking to the people of a random society, maybe people of even a later society, and you're saying to them, guys, this is how we should do things. This is the right and just way, or this is the democratic way, and you give reasons of one sort or another, which reasons you give, of course, will vary with which basic political philosophy you adopt. But I hope that, in any case, the image of doing political theory in a citizen-centered mode, that's to say an addressive and inclusive mode, and it's clear the way in which it serves as an alternative to thinking of political theory in a more consumer-centered way. Now, what I want to say, just as I said with the consumer-centered approach, that if you think of political theory in that way, you'll tend to think of, you know, the two dimensions I've talked about, the horizontal and vertical dimension, the dimension of democracy and the dimension of social justice. You'll think of them as, yeah, more or less on a par, you know, one's important, both are important. You know, you might in this case rank one more highly than another and reverse it in another case. But now suppose you're thinking in the citizen-centered way, and you're recommending to people that they should do this, that, or the other. Suppose you're making recommendations to them, to your fellow citizens. You're speaking as a citizen inter quives, among citizens, and you're saying, this is the sort of health system we should have, or this is the sort of case where we should go Keynesian, you know, rather than for austerity, to take a contemporary sort of example. Or you go through basic institutions that ought to be changed and you speak to them. Then you're offering them reasons of an address of kind that you expect them to be capable of registering and capable of individually doing their part in acting on. And capable, that's to say, therefore, of collectively acting on. And you're saying, guys, this is what we should do. Can't you see? Here are my reasons. And now, of course, your expectation is that they will act on the reasons you're giving, but only if they accept those reasons. Only if they don't think those reasons are trumped by other considerations that point in another direction. You're treating them, in a phrase I like, as conversable, you know, people who can be brought into conversation, just as you are with an individual when you tell him that he ought to wear a suit to interview or whatever it might be. You're treating the person as someone who has the capacity to understand what you're saying and respond to it. Equally, in this case, in doing citizen-centered theory, the recommendations you're making to other people, considered not just as consumers of arrangements, but as the people whom you're giving reasons for building institutions of this kind or another. But now think about it. If you're giving people reasons to act on of this kind, which you accept, they should act on only if they accept them. You're offering the reasons in a take it or leave it way, then your assumption is that if they act on these reasons, if they go for the institutions that you're recommending, if they, so to speak, buy your political philosophy and your political recommendations, then you're assuming that they will do so only insofar as they are persuaded of those considerations and sufficiently jointly persuaded of those considerations in order to act on them. But that's to say that in some shape or form, you're assuming, in making the recommendations, that if they act on them, they will act on them democratically. That's to say, they will take them and act on them as co-participants in a freely undertaken exercise of constructing their institutions or changing their institutions in one way or another. So in making the recommendations, you're already presupposing that they will act democratically. So whatever recommendations you're making about how things should be, whether they be recommendations in the area of healthcare or financial organizations or indeed political organizations, we'll come to that in a moment, you're making the recommendations on the presupposition that wherever they go in following your advice, they will go democratically. They will go on the basis of freely acting together on the considerations you offer, or perhaps on a variation on those considerations that turns up as a result of their own discussion or the intervention of other people. Someone might say at this point, but wait a moment, I mean, couldn't you give considerations to people, presupposing that they will act on them democratically, since you're doing the theory, you're making the recommendations in a citizen-centered way, that's to say an addressive and inclusive way, couldn't you give them considerations that give them a reason democratically to bring into play a dispensation, an arrangement, a constitution that is very undemocratic? I mean, after all, you might be presupposing that they'll act in your considerations, but the considerations might be, listen, guys, what you should do is pick a family, create a monarch, give him or her absolute power, and have, let's suppose, succession determined by some rules of birth and heritage, inheritance. Couldn't you do that consistently with what I've said? Well, strictly speaking, yes, except when I treat you as, when I treat us as conversable, giving these recommendations, it's hard to see how even as I presuppose conversability, the capacity to act on reasons and to act together on reasons, it's hard to see what reason I could give you to abdicate, so to speak, that conversability. Certainly, I think that's true in any political philosophy, but it's certainly going to be true in the Republican way of thinking. So, for example, what reasons could I give my fellow citizens for why we should abdicate the control that's presupposed in the very act of my making recommendations, our control over what we do? What reasons can I give them, give us, for abdicating that control in favor of alienating, well, as it used to be said, sovereignty in another body? And it's very hard to see what reasons you could give, because after all, say in a Republican way of thinking, if someone has control like that, then that means straight away that you're going to have public domination, because that body that's given control rather than the people retaining control is going to be uncontrolled by the people, so there's certainly an immediate loss in public domination. And of course, there's also the possibility, clearly, that the body you empower in that way might, recognizing the power it has, just give up on the whole enterprise of running anything we would regard as a state and introduce a sort of mafia-type regime in which not only do we not have a government we control, but we don't really have government at all. We have a body that is now given the power to dominate us privately as well as publicly. This, of course, will remind many of you. Do you remember that passage in Rousseau early in the social contract where, well, let me back up a little. Rousseau, the Hobbes that Rousseau knew was the Hobbes of De Quive, basically. Rousseau didn't, so far as we know, have any knowledge of Leviathan. And in De Quive and the earlier work, which you may also have known, The Elements of Law, what Hobbes imagines is that as a state forms, the first stage is that people become their own sovereign. It's a bit like the Rousseauvian assembly. He imagines that everyone unanimously agrees that they will each be bound by majority voting. And then in that early work, he says that such a democratic sovereign, the committee of the whole of people, is going to have a choice between keeping the sovereignty, keeping the ultimate control, remaining a democracy, as he calls it, or abdicating that control, giving over control irrevocably to either an aristocratic committee or a monarch. And Rousseau, early in the social contract, raises the question about whether the people could ever have a reason to abdicate control in that way in favor of an aristocracy or a monarchy. And he says this actually not in discussing Hobbes, but in discussing Grotius, because Grotius had endorsed that Hobbesian sort of thought that that might be a reasonable thing for people to do. And Rousseau argues at that point, if you remember, that only, I think his phrase is, only a nation of madmen could ever abdicate control. I mean, he doesn't give much of an argument, but he's clearly just so frustrated with the thought that it might be regarded as reasonable for people to abdicate control. So let's think of that as just a little interlude now. That isn't serving the purpose of my argument particularly, except to say that it's nice to know that I've got Rousseau on side at this point. Because Rousseau is also saying, there's no reason you could give to people, and I think he is thinking of political theory very much in a citizen-centered way of addressing, you know, people as to what we should be doing. And like Rousseau, I think that you've got to presuppose that people, as you address, are going to act democratically in whatever recommendations you make, and consistently regarding them as conversable, capable of keeping control like that, you're not going to have any reason you can give them for them to abdicate such control. So that in adopting the citizen-centered approach to doing political theory, I think inevitably you presuppose that things are going to be done democratically by the people you're addressing. Okay, now at this point what I'd like to do is to look at three questions that I've put on the and the handout to their questions addressed to the position that I've begun to sketch. So one question is this. I've suggested that as I make recommendations to my fellow citizens or to the random population of citizens in any society about how they should order affairs, for example, about how they should order, as I said, property law, welfare arrangements, and so on through all of the areas of policymaking, I suggested that I've always got to assume in making these recommendations in this mode that they're going to do it democratically. But someone might say, well, wait a moment, doesn't the same go for making recommendations to them about democratic institutions themselves? I mean, it goes, as I've suggested, for the case where I make recommendations about the horizontal dimension of justice, roughly, but doesn't it also go, I might say to them, look, what you ought to do is have two houses of parliament, let's suppose, to which you elect people on a different basis, and you ought to have a constitutional court, I say. Now, I'm making recommendations, after all, here about how democracy itself should be organized, aren't I? So it's not just that I presuppose democracy in making recommendations about matters of justice. I presuppose democracy, it appears, in making recommendations on matters of democracy itself. And someone might suggest, isn't there a sort of circle? There's something worrying about that? Now I want to say, yes, I think the same goes for making recommendations about democratic institutions, but there isn't anything worrying or surprising about that. Because as I say to people, what you ought to do is set up, say, a bicameral legislature of the two houses of parliament, I'm still assuming that the way in which they're going to establish those institutions, i.e. on the basis of my having persuaded them and they're persuading one another and they're acting together on this, I'm assuming that how they will do that is itself democracy. So there's no problem in thinking that recommendations I make, either in the horizontal or the vertical dimension, just simply presuppose that the ultimate mode of implementation is democratic. Of course, the ultimate mode of implementation of any recommendations may be democratic, including recommendations about how the democratic mode of implementation should itself be developed and elaborated and what forms that it should take. So there's no particular problem there. Second question. Couldn't I make recommendations in this citizen-centered way, this addressive and inclusive way, and indeed make recommendations that quite undemocratic institutions should be introduced? For example, it might be a time of terrorist threats, and I might make recommendations about various emergency procedures that ought to be put in place that maybe modify democratic institutions quite considerably. Let's take an example from a completely different age. Florence in the late 1100s and 1200s and many other Italian cities had great problems with organizing their democratic institutions, mainly because of the enormous rivalry and conflict between the different parties in each city. And many cities decided on the following, you might think of it, emergency, and really, in a way, quite undemocratic procedure, which is that they established a podestà in the city to run things for usually about 6 months, and the podestà was always someone from another city who was brought in like a professional and was given enormous powers, actually, administrative and military powers as well, and told to run the city, almost made a plenipotentiary, as you might think of it. And at the end of the 6 months, he went on his way, but not before he was called before a council of the citizens who grilled him, basically. You know, called him to account on how he managed things and tried to ensure that there hadn't been corruption, there hadn't been favoritism, and so on during his tenure of office. Now, couldn't I, in making recommendations, say, you know, what we ought to do around here, say under various circumstances, is go for a podestat type arrangement? And isn't that, so to speak, giving the lie to what I've been saying? And I want to say no, because what I'm recommending in a case like that is the introduction of an arrangement that doesn't involve abdicating the equally shared control of the citizenry, but rather involves temporarily passing over the administration, so to speak, to another body, but always in such a way that the people retain ultimate control. The podestat is called to account at the end of the 6 months. And actually, the regime of the podestat was introduced in a way that guarded against his becoming a center of corruption or usurpation of popular power. So, for example, I understand the podestat in many cities was required to share, you know, to live in different parts of the city so that he wouldn't become, in the course of his tenure of office, so that he wouldn't become over-friendly with any particular group, and was required sometimes not to eat, for example, his meals with members of the local population. He was, you know, forced to keep a distance from everybody, so to speak, in order to ensure his sort of impartiality. So, consistently with what I'm saying, it's what's really required, what you can't give up on, is what I call here fallback democracy, the sort of ultimate control of the people. And it's consistent that with this line that in some emergency circumstances you might introduce institutions that, so to speak, weaken or postpone that degree of control, provided that there still is ultimate control in the hands of the citizenry. So now, third question, I think the third question is the most interesting. What I'm suggesting is that when I make recommendations about justice and how things should be organized in the social order between people, I'm suggesting that I should not expect any such recommendations to be implemented unless they are democratically endorsed. So every recommendation I make in justice is subject to a democratic proviso. After all, if I were saying, this is what should be done, and I'm just, you know, telling you I'm going to force it on you, then I wouldn't be addressing you as conversable subjects. I wouldn't be regarding you as people who are conversable, who can talk back, who only act on recommendations that they accept and endorse. So when I make recommendations in this citizen-centered way about justice, I'm certainly saying, look, none of my recommendations, I don't expect any of them to be acted on, I say, any one of us says as a political theorist, any one of us says as a citizen, unless they're democratically endorsed, unless people are won around to them, and under whatever institutions are currently in play, unless they implement them via those institutions that give them ideally equal control or say in the implementation. But now here's the third question. Isn't there one exception to that, which is that when I recommend, as certainly I would do, and probably most of us would do, as certainly I would do from the Republican point of view, when I recommend to people that, look, there should be a democracy. That is to say, there should be a regime under which people have control of some level over what happens in their lives, and that control is equally shared so that, you know, no one is specially privileged. When I say that, because in the very act of making any recommendation, I'm assuming that people are the ones who are going to be the makers of it, and therefore I'm assuming that they will do it democratically. When I say they should do it democratically, in that sense, isn't that the one recommendation that's not subject to a democratic proviso? So the very fact that in making any recommendations, I presuppose that they're going to be acted on democratically, and I endorse them only if they are democratically endorsed, means paradoxically that the recommendation that they do things democratically is itself a recommendation. I say, that's the one recommendation I say, you can't back off, and it's not just up to you to agree to it. See, if I say you should have this health system or that health system or this property system, that property system, I'm putting it forward as a citizen among citizens, and I expect them to be acted on only if you agree to it. But when I say we should do things in a way that's democratic, in which each of us has equal sort of share in the control involved, I'm not saying, oh, provided, of course, you democratically agree to it. That's a sort of, well, let me make this paradox more. The paradox can be put in the following terms. The fact that a decision is made democratically does not mean, even in, you know, the fullest strength of democracy, does not mean that the result of that decision is a democratic arrangement. So, for example, you can imagine a society where the beliefs are such amongst the members of the citizenry that they all listen to the local political theorist, and they all are invited to act democratically on, let's suppose, his political recommendations, and they're all persuaded by him that only men should have the vote, that henceforth only men should determine what happens. And now imagine that they vote on this, and imagine at the very extreme that they unanimously vote up a system under which women are systematically denied the vote so that they will no longer share equally in the control of what happens in government. Then, of course, I say, that is a that would be a democratic decision at the end, that leads from a democracy to a non-democracy. The way of putting this is, democracy does not define itself. The fact that a decision is taken democratically does not mean that the decision preserves democracy. And that, in turn, is the reason why, when I speak as a political theorist, citizen to citizen, in the citizen-centered way, and presuppose that things will be done democratically, I make a commitment to things being done democratically that is, well, I want to say sort of absolute. It's not that things should be done democratically, provided that's democratically endorsed by the people. It's that things should be done democratically, period. So the irony of where this argument leads, I hope this is sort of clear, it's a little tricky, but the ironic aspect of the conclusion is that when one speaks as a philosopher, you always speak sub judice. The recommendations you make are under, so to speak, the proviso that others will agree to them, that they'll be enacted democratically. And to speak as a philosopher in any other voice would be to speak as a guru, not as a philosopher, to speak as a, for that matter, as an ideologue, you know, rather than speaking in the manner we take to be dialogical and characteristic of our discipline. But the one exception to that, the one place where the philosopher speaks and makes recommendations, period, rather than making recommendations provided they're democratically endorsed, is when the philosopher says there should be a democracy. And this is the sense in which, if I can come wind towards an end, which I think that if you do political theory in the citizen-centered way, then your commitment to democracy is really basic and sort of absolute to at least some form of ultimate democratic control. And that's what I mean by saying that I think of democracy as being having a certain priority over, for example, recommendations about justice. Understanding justice in my sense now. And after all, you can say everything I've just said by saying that, look, we've got to presuppose political justice of a certain kind, minimum political justice, and that's the core thing we can never give up on so long as we speak as philosophers, that's to say as citizens among citizens, recommending to others how things should be done. And when you make recommendations in social justice or in very specific aspects of political justice, you do so subject to the proviso that they'll be introduced, implemented in a politically just way, that's to say a democratic way. But the basic commitment is indeed that, that they shall be done in a democratic way or a politically just way. And that's a commitment which has a certain priority. Okay, of course, having said all of this, you might say, well, maybe if you went this citizen-centered way in doing political theory, I could buy your argument and think that there's a certain priority you have to give democracy, if you think of that way. But why should I not adopt the consumer-centered approach rather than the citizen-centered approach? Now, let me say on this, I do think a lot of our evaluative enterprises are done in a consumer-centered manner. And I don't think there's anything, as it were, that's wrong with that. But I think that, for example, you know, when, think about the, I don't know whether you know this, but I think it's actually worth recommending, the Economist Intelligence Unit, which you can get on the web, associated with the Economist magazine, which I used to think of as right-wing, but it's now more or less on the left in current political times. But the Economist Intelligence Unit has an audit of democracies, meaning an audit of systems around the world and how far they score on what most of us would regard as reasonable criteria. And that's a purely consumer-centered, as it were, way of doing things. And it serves, obviously, quite a useful purpose. And economists do this all the time. In fact, economists think of their enterprise, in many cases, as essentially a consumer-centered enterprise. But if, in doing political theory, you're really talking to fellow citizens in a way that's supposed to be action-guiding. Of course, the consumer-centered is action-guiding in a way, too. It's sort of saying, this is the sort of place you should want to live, you know? This is the one you should choose if you did have a choice. But the more natural way of doing an action-guiding sort of normative theory is, I think, in a manner where you treat the people you're talking to as other minds that are conversable as your mind is conversable, to which you give reasons that you expect them to register and respond to, either with contrary reasons or with agreeing with you, and if they agree with you, with acting on them. And if, and that's, of course, the very epitome of respect, as we call it, it's the dialogical or discourse-compatible sort of way in which human beings can deal with one another. And if you think about that as the mode in which you're relating to other people, then I think there's a natural attraction to thinking of your theory in the citizen-centered mode. But you might say, there seems to be something quite wrong about this, you might think. I mean, look, there are two ways of thinking about what you're doing in political theory. And what you're telling us is that if you think about what you're doing in this way, you're going to give priority to democracy, whereas if you think of the other way, you're not. And that sounds crazy. Why should just the way the caste in which you do your theory have such an effect on the content of your recommendations? And in response to that query, I can make a reference again to Habermas, you know, Frankfurt, Habermas, you know, it's a strong association in the minds of those of us who live elsewhere, even to this day.